Is it Rolling Bob?
Talking Dylan.
He's your host, Lucas Hare.
He's your host, Carrie Shale.
But he's our special guest, performer and writer Christopher Green.
I ain't saying you treated me unkind. You could have done better, hey, but I don't mind you. Just kind of wasted my precious time. But don't think twice, it's all right.
Christopher Green, that was lovely.
Thank you.
Welcome. Why did you choose those lines? We asked you to choose some lines. Why those?
Because it's a song that I think I heard lots and lots of times, loads of different versions, before I kind of went, oh, that's a Bob Dylan song. Oh, wow, that's interesting. And then that sort of, then I kind of unpacked it a little bit. And then I'm like, oh, I can see why that would be a Dylan song. But I kind of thought it was, I think I probably heard it like Indigo Girls first, and then it sort of worked its way through to different things, and then Joan Baez, who I love, Joan Baez, and then I kind of thought maybe it was hers, and then I actually found out that it wasn't, which is like a brilliant mistake to make if you think that it might have been Joan Baez and not Dylan. Anyway, so I thought that was a kind of an interesting way in, and it might affect what we talk about later, but also it's like, you know, we all should be questioning who's wasting our precious time in this modern world. Yeah, I'm intrigued by Dylan. I have an interesting relationship with him. And I thought it was quite fun to come on and talk about that, and maybe in a slightly different way. And also, you can tell me why I should be wasting my precious time on him.
We should tell you.
Yeah.
Wow.
There you go.
Gosh, there you go, turn
things around a little bit.
Yeah. It's like an addicts group already.
Yeah, like, are you sure you're not wasting your time?
Yeah.
Well,
he'll change
this?
Your life.
Sure. Well, I kind of like feel like I've had a relationship with him for a long time without really admitting it. Do you know what I mean? Because he's such a big
part of
a secret relationship. I mean, he talks well of me, but but you know, sort of like goes all the way back. So I think the first time I was conscious of him was when I heard Marlene Dietrich sing the Antwoord mein Freund, weiß ganz allein der Wind. And I was like, what's this? This is weird.
I thought you were going to say she sang Don't Think Twice. It's all right.
No, that would be amazing.
Don't think twice. It's all right.
That would be great. But why did Dietrich not do a whole album of Dylan covers? Why stop with, you know, why stop with The Answer Is Blowing in the Wind? And I loved that song so much. And I thought, and then when I heard her singing it in English, I was like, this is amazing. You know, I'm talking about when I was like 9 or something. And I just thought this was amazing. And then I was like, okay, so yeah, so he wrote that. And then I kind of moved away from him. And thought he was, you know, he represented the patriarchy, and you know, and all those kind of things. I was like, boo.
But when was that that you gave
moved
up
away?
On? Yeah,
probably in my sort of in my teens, in my sort of, you know, I was like, I thought I was radical. Then so there was an Everything But the Girls song. So Tracy Thorne wrote a song. Which you do you know this song? There's a song called Me and Bobby D.
Oh, no.
Nope.
Which is there we go. Let's discuss this, boys.
Yeah.
So there's, so it's obviously a riff on Me and Bobby McGee. And it goes, me and Bobby D never got on that famously. A sinner and a saint he may be. Me and Bobby D don't get along that easily. You told the world, be free, love life. Tell me, is it true you beat your wife? Yeah. So I was kind of 17 or 16 or whenever that kid came out, and I was like, oh, okay, so I think he's nice. And instead of just kind of examining it for myself, I was like, whoa, okay. And then the second verse, she goes on to talk about me and Saint Jack Hay never had much to say. It's easy driving with your feet with some good old girl in the passenger seat. While you're out of your head, who's making the bed? You know, it's a good provocation of a song.
Yeah.
And then I think, so I was like, I don't like him. Because he represents all those things that I don't like. You know,
did you learn more about him through this before actually ingesting his music then, do you think? Do you think you built this impression?
Yes, I think I'd built up that impression, and then it's taken me ages to sort of work my way back.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It
and
does.
So in a way, when, you know, when this was mentioned to me, I was like, oh, yeah, I have a kind of problematic relationship with him, but actually there's lots of songs that I relate to and then things that I just cut myself off from because I go, oh, no, he's the voice of the patriarchy and he can't even sing. Do you know what I mean? That would be my sort of like...
Certainly
holding for.
Yeah, everybody and anybody can say he can't sing. That's like
absolutely
an easy
we
thing
know
to
that.
Say. But
yeah.
I always thought he was the voice of the patriarchy, yeah, too, in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
And his attitudes to women were, you know, questionable. Mm. But then he's so much bigger than that, ultimately.
Yeah, sure. And then there's that whole thing of, like, should we overlook biography in order, you know, is biography inherent to our liking or disliking somebody? And I think that's very interesting, and if we get an insight into a different mindset from our own, then that's incredibly valuable. It's an interesting little,
because these days it's spread to, you know, film producers and directors and other actors or whoever. So it's,
and you become, yeah, and that's such an incredibly problematic discussion, you know, like, can you have a career if you're going to behave badly? Well, you know, no, in many instances, but, you know, ultimately people have to take responsibility for their own actions. Also, when people were in a very different time. So I don't know.
So did something pull you back? Did you spend years not listening to him?
Yes, definitely. And then I think I then started to just join up, like we were saying, that's why I picked Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, and just like go, oh yeah, he wrote that song and I really like that song. Mm. So actually, oh, maybe I should kind of look at that a little bit more, and then go, yeah, that's a really great song. Wow. And then I'll go back to the original and then sort of like get over the things that I think I don't like, my prejudices. So basically it's about, can we overcome our prejudices?
Mm-hmm. And there are lots of different versions of that song. I grew up with Johnny Cash's version, which, Understand Your Man as well, is basically Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, isn't it? Before he recorded it. So it was kind of in the air around then. But there's, I mean, Dolly Parton's done it, hasn't she? And loads of people.
I mean, yeah, it seems like everyone's had a crack at it, doesn't it? And
so it's wonderful. Did you see Dylan live? That's always something that...
No, I haven't seen Dylan live.
And have you been tempted or just...
No, I definitely... So I used to work in the music industry a long time ago. I was in my early 20s. I worked on a program called The Word.
Oh, yes.
I was the music researcher on The Word.
Oh, I did a thing with Katie Puckrick, actually.
Did
just
you?
Last year. Yeah, she was great.
Oh, she is great.
But she was pissed off because people kept saying, you're very 80s. Yeah. She's not. She's still alive and she's not 80. She looks great. But
And it was the 90s anyway.
Yeah, oh, was it the 90s?
Yeah. Okay, but, 90s. But it is a long time ago.
Yeah. But anyway, tell me.
And so I kind of worked in that, and there was no way. So I would have undoubtedly been offered tickets to go and see him, and at that time I'd have been like, are you kidding me?
Then there's another
way that Dylan worked hard to redeem himself with me, which I know has been keeping him away.
Yes, he's written about it,
which is through Roy Orbison, who I love.
Oh yeah.
So that whole kind of George Harrison, Roy Orbison, remind me what they're called, the
Traveling
Wilburys, exactly. And that whole kind of way, and I'm just like, oh wow, this is so great. So I can't just like pretend I don't hear the lines that he sings, you know.
Well, absolutely. I'm not a huge Tom Petty fan or a huge Jeff Lynne fan, but I have to just, you know, when I'm listening to Traveling Wilburys, I go, well, it's all okay, you know.
It's good enough for the big O.
Yeah,
exactly.
Doesn't Tom Petty and Dylan, don't they sort of like sing a lot of songs on... I'm here to... What's that? Supply the words, please.
Oh, God. We Are the World.
No. This is a terrible game. You know, I'm so tired of being lonely.
That's a bit...
But George Harrison wrote that.
Everybody got somebody.
Those two sing together on that.
They both got some gravelly kind of voices, I think.
Yeah, so did that pull you in? You were pulled back in by the Traveling Wilburys.
I was pulled back and I was like, I don't know what I feel about this because, you know, I quite like it.
But I mean, because it's totally inoffensive as a... none of the songs, you know, that you can't really, I think, get offended by Traveling Wilburys.
No, absolutely. And they're really... Yeah, I mean, it's just... oozes elegance and class and expertise and all of that. So, you know, nobody could put up any barriers to that.
And then what did he do after you would know this?
After the Traveling Wilburys, it was Mercy, and then another Traveling Wilburys album.
Oh Mercy. Yeah. Were you on board for Oh Mercy?
No, I wasn't. With who?
Daniel Lanois produced it.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah.
And it's got this swampy New Orleans kind of
So I was aware of it. And, of course, I loved the album that he produced with Emmylou Harris. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Wrecking Ball,
which is just wonderful. Amazing. So you see, I denied myself the thing. This
the
is what
stuff.
It's like.
And Emily Harris, of course, is on Desire.
Yes, you know, I do. Yeah, you see, as long as I've got a way in, I'm fine.
There's little touchstones, yeah.
I kind of want to do some sort of weird metaphor about, like, when you're at an orgy with a friend and you don't look in their face. But you know what I mean? I was sort of like, I will ignore them. But that metaphor doesn't work. But you know what I mean? It's sort of like, I can ignore you as long as I'm not confronted by your presence.
So you were never influenced by Dylan's kind of shape-shifting, his identities,
I was aware
his
of it. I mean, you know, everybody's aware of all of that.
Yeah.
And the, you know, the reinvention and everything. But for my work, definitely not.
Because that's what I assume. Because when I looked into your work, and it's the range is enormous. Mm. And there are lots of different identities. And they go off at real tangents from others. And I was preparing, thinking, we're going to talk to Christopher, he's a Bob Dylan fan, this must be why. You know, this must be the natural connection, but no, I'm totally wrong.
But also, I've only recently, weirdly, in the last kind of 4 or 5 years, come to Bowie, which is really strange. Like, what was I doing? I was obsessed with music.
Yeah.
But also, you know, I didn't have... I'm the oldest. I didn't really have anyone older than me sort of like saying, you really need to listen to Bowie. So I kind of went, oh, wow, China Girl, that's great. Yeah. You know, which is like the wrong time to be coming into the world.
So that I like China
kind of,
Girl.
Yeah, no, my little China I'm good.
Yeah, exactly.
So brilliant. Yeah, it's great, but it's not, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe not. But so I wasn't really influenced by that kind of thing.
No.
I think I always just had a sort of instinct that if you're going to be an artist, in however you define that, then you should just do what interests you.
Yeah.
And if you're not following what you're interested in, then you're not really making work. Mm. But that's probably why I'm in the situation I am, where I'm just doing loads of disparate things.
Yeah.
But when you did Tina C, were you into country music?
Yeah.
So were you into old country as opposed to...
I was in... So I, after I worked on The Word, I did quite a few other pop music shows, and I went to Nashville to make a country music documentary in like 1993 without knowing anything about country music really. And I completely fell in love with like new country and was just... You know, there was like a revelation. I was like, this is my music, you know. And mainly, not a surprise, but, you know, Reba McEntire and Wynonna Judd and people, and those kind of new country women, which then just immediately when I started performing just was like, oh, I'll just be one of them.
Yeah.
And I just made somebody who was like that, which was Tina C. So I definitely was a country music fan, and I still am a country music fan, and I keep up with kind of new country, even though it's like massively overproduced and, you know, all of that. So that's, I have a kind of real love-hate relationship with that.
What do you make of Miranda Lambert, just off, because I think she's great.
Yeah, I really, really love her. And I'll happily go with Carrie Underwood. You know, Kacey Musgraves absolutely loved her. I've loved her since she started, and so now her kind of like flowering. It's
massive.
Really,
I went to my wife and I went to the C2C concert in March last year at the O2. I had a great time, but there were a lot of people. I think it was a 3-day event, and I was primarily there to see Emmylou Harris. But a lot of people insisted on doing the whole thing. They were dressing up in the cowboy hats and the check shirts and the jeans and stuff. And we were telling some of our friends about it, and they were saying, yeah, if you're going to go and see country music, you've got to dress up, haven't you? I was like, for me, not so much. I'm kind of there for the music, but am I missing the point?
I went to one of those things years ago before it had a title. It was sort of just American country music comes to Wembley Arena. And this was back in the 80s with a friend of mine who was the only country music person that I knew. Mm. And it was about half to three quarters full. They'd taken the seats out so you could just stand and mill around and everything. And it went on all day. It was like, you know, stock. And the only thing that I remember was like the most country moment I've ever seen in my life. Somebody came out. I think it might have been Ferlin Husky, but I'm not sure. But it was somebody along those lines who had been great and had done some great stuff, but was a bit on the downs. And he sang a few songs, and then he brought out his wife, and her name was Kimmy Rhodes. I remember Kimmy Rhodes. So it might not have been Ferlin Husky, but it was definitely Kimmy Rhodes. She was small, and she petite, and she had a country, you know, the cowboy thing and everything. Mm-hmm. And they sang a couple of songs together. That's completely unremarkable. Then she walked over to him, and slapped him across the face and walked off. I don't know what was going on. It was like something was going on. And that was, it was great. And he just, oh, the little lady, and just broke into another song. And I thought, I don't know what was going on, but I thought that was the most marvelous country moment I've ever seen, because he had done her wrong in some way, shape, or form.
That's what you get when you're on a tour bus 24/7.
Yeah.
That intensity. I mean, there's a thing for me about that country is inherently theatrical, and that might be connected to what you were
It's so emotional.
Yes, and it's very performed. It's very performative, and it's got very clear narratives, and it plays up to itself and all of that. And of course, you know, I loved that. And maybe I never quite got that about with Dylan. I mean, it's easy to see that with
Dylan. What about Dylan's country stuff?
Yes. So then I made myself explore Dylan's country stuff, and I was like, it's not emotional enough for me, it doesn't make me cry. So that's the question for me, is like, what Dylan songs will make me cry, because none of them have ever done with him singing them. I don't know, this is great. I'll go and work it out.
I was listening to the new self-portrait today, just for my own enjoyment, and it's very emotional. It's just, I mean, people hated it when it came out. If you really listen to it properly, he invests all those things, even Blue Moon, you know, even a old corny kind of classic. And everything on Nashville Skyline, and I Threw It All Away is one of the saddest songs ever.
And so I need to kind of, because it's funny how I just was like, I don't buy it, but I can see what he's doing, but I don't buy it. And then some of the things that I've listened to in the last few years, I was intrigued by that. When was it? It was only a couple of years ago when he did that sort of cover version of He's Funny That Way for the gay marriage thing. And so I was sort of aware of that, you know, in a cliched way. And I was like, oh, this will be terrible. Like, why is he doing this? And then I was like, oh, that's quite nice.
It's quite nice. And it's to date his most recent recording, I think.
Right, is it? Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But also there's, I mean, with the emotive side of his music, there's, I think, a way in sometimes is through covers. I mean, you mentioned Wrecking Ball. There's a fabulous cover on that Emmylou Harris album of Every Grain of Sand, which I find very moving.
Absolutely, yeah.
If you ever see me weeping on a train in the small hours at the moment, I'm probably listening to Marianne Faithfull singing It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, which is from the album from last year, which just sounds like the end of the world.
Who do I know sing the song?
Lots of people. I mean, Them with Van Morrison did it. And Marianne Faithfull did it actually again, but this most recent version that she did, someone sent me, and it just, Stephen, if you're listening, and it just is the most moving thing I've heard for months. It just tears me to pieces. I mean, I recommend you listen to it, but don't do it on a train. Don't do it in public.
And as a performer, Do you think he's really sophisticated as a performer? Do you think he's sort of playing with all these different kind of levels of, and personas, and so he's not?
I mean, there's to be a film finally of the Rolling Thunder tour in 1975, and he was playing with performance all the way through that. You know, he was in whiteface and lots of mascara and the weird hats, because the hats in themselves are, you know, a performance each time. You know, like these weird, I don't know if you've seen what he's wearing boleros, and it's all a performance. We had somebody else who said that Dylan inhabits his performances, as opposed to this particular person felt that Bowie was trying to find out who he was, but that Dylan knew who he was. He was this person at this time, and then
put it.
I have to say, I find his stuff kind of frightening. The last 20 years or so, I find more frightening than moving, and frightening in a kind of a good way, in that like he's aware of the universe. It's more about the universe than little things like, will I be loved?
Love me back.
Also, outside his music, I mean, the greatest performance I think Dylan ever gave was the one from most of the 80s and 90s, was a rock star who didn't give a shit and who lost all will to live or exist in any real sense. And then he thought, well, he's had it. And he'd read an interview and you'd see just how vibrant and alive his mind was. And you'd think, well, this is all a performance, this guy at the airport with a hood who can't really string a sentence together. It's all a performance. And that's just to alienate himself, I guess, and get people off his back.
I am really, really fascinated by that. And the, you know, the also alienating people and scaring people and, you know, all these things is really fantastic thing to do. And especially in an age of us all being very desperate to please. But also that notion of everything being performance is very, you know, and that's definitely where my work is at the moment. You know, that idea of hidden performance and secret performance and all that kind of thing. So not without like going, right, we will be performing in 5 minutes. Now we are performing, so everyone knows what's going on. It's like, it's so refreshing, I think.
But I was just thinking this morning, I was telling Luke, I had a dream about this, about Bob Dylan last night. And then when I woke up, I thought, this thing came into my head, there was this fairly well-known interview when he was doing Hearts of Fire, the thing, terrible film with Rupert Everett.
Yeah, yeah.
And the BBC interviewed him in his little caravan, and he tore the reporter apart, basically. He led him a merry dance, but basically just left him sort of steaming by the side of the road. Then he went outside, and it was being filmed in Canada. It was in this, they were parked in this parking lot in Toronto. And the local kids came around, and he sort of gave them autographs. And this big, burly guy who looked like he'd stepped out of Altamont. He looked like a kind of, he looked like he'd been to Altamont. He had long white, he looked like Grizzly Adams.
Right, yeah.
And so long white hair, big, big old beard, big old pot belly. And he just sort of came up to him and just said, I love you, man. And gave him a big hug, gave Bob Dylan a hug without any of this sitting around asking Bob Dylan about stuff. And at least that's how I remember it. I have to go back and look at it again, but I think that's what happens. Or maybe it was just in my dream. But I thought this, he was treating Bob Dylan like a human being. It's just sort of like boom, which hardly ever happens to people who don't know Dylan. I'm sure he's got his intimate friends him like a human being, but most other people don't.
But that notion of him being this kind of like untouchable figure, I mean, of course he's going to play up to that if he's in any way sensible and, you know, not insane.
Well, who would want that, you know?
Yeah, all the time, yeah.
I mean, we in the early 21st century, I think we have a fairly solid understanding of what fame can do to people, but when he started, there was no notion, particularly not if you're by yourself, unlike the Beatles, you know, there was no way of planning. I mean, Elvis Presley, I don't think, understood it either, just of knowing what would happen in the eye of that particular storm. It seems to me entirely natural to want to get people off your back and pretend to be someone else all the time.
Yeah. So tell me about the CD that I own because I really like it, which is the Christmas album, which somebody gave it me, and I was like, "This is going to be really what's going on." Actually, I really loved it.
Well, let's give that some time because there's only one of you, or maybe two of you
I
in
know,
the world.
But maybe that's being I'm being contrary, but I'm not because I thought, "Oh, well, what's going on?" And actually, I was like, this is what we should do with Christmas. Is he just undercutting everything about Christmas?
I don't know. I like, is the big song Must Be Christmas?
Must Be Santa.
Yeah. That I liked, and I loved the video. And I'm not a big Christmas carol person.
I'm not a big
Christmas song guy. So to me, and then I heard, I think it was... was it A Little Town of Bethlehem?
Yeah. Is that the one with the children's choir on there was, a lot?
I've not listened to these songs at that point.
I just turned it off. I've never listened to it again.
But I really, like, I love doing Christmas shows and I love sort of, like, undercutting it, but not trying too hard to undercut it, but with that sentimentality and then playing with sentimentality.
But do you think he was undercutting it?
I don't know. But that's what's so weird about it. But, like, you don't have that many children singing on a thing without making a point.
You just don't know, do you?
It's not casual.
No.
I think it was 2009 when that came out, and I remember about 3 years before when he was doing the radio show, when he was doing Theme Time Radio Hour, he had a Christmas-themed episode, and he played a song by a band called Brave Combo called Must Be Santa.
Right. Mm.
And I'd never heard it before. I went and bought it on iTunes afterwards because me and my then little son really enjoyed listening to it in the car. And then when he announced that he was doing this Christmas album, and the track listing came out before the album did, and it said he's doing Must Be Santa, and I thought, it can't be the same song. He hasn't got the energy to do that. he'd fall over, he'd collapse, there's no way. And yes, sure enough, there it is, note for note, pretty much the same performance. Yeah. And my son, who was a bit older, walked in when I was playing it once, and he said, Daddy, is Bob Dylan ill? Because he sounded so, so appalling. I don't know. Maybe there are riches in this album that I need to go and experience again.
But he does have a really good sense of irony, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
And he's also, like, I've heard all the Theme Time. Have you heard the Theme Time Radio Hour?
No, I was reading about it today, to be honest. So I know it totally passed me by, but I was reading about it and I was like, this sounds great.
Kerry pointed out to me, they're all available as a podcast.
Right.
Yeah, they're all on, just get them for free on the Apple podcast.
Yeah.
It's great. And one of the things is that he does all the great themes, mothers, fathers. Mm. And then he does marriage, he does divorce. And, you know, he was famously married and famously divorced. But it's all like it's happening to somebody else. Like everything is sort of... But there's one, my favorite moment of the Theme Time Radio, I don't know when it happens, is I think occasionally he takes letters, and sometimes they're real letters and sometimes they're fake.
Mm. I don't think they're ever real.
Well, sure. There was one.
Maybe he believes it.
Yes, he believes it. I believe in Don't Ruin It. It's yes. Santa. Yes. But anyway, there was one that, real or fake, it was sort of, I'm having trouble sort of finding some meaning in my life, Bob. Can you help me? And Bob, in his, you know, Bob Dylan voice, sort of said, you should do charity work. You should go out and work with other people and get your mind off yourself. Mm. And it was one of his longest, it became a kind of a really heartfelt missive to the public. It was like he was off script. And unless I'm dreaming it,
you're looking at one of your Bob Dylan dreams.
I don't know. I remember him saying that. And I thought, that's another side of Bob I would have never have guessed.
No. Has he been doing secret charity work? Now there's a sitcom.
Absolutely.
This week, Bob tries.
Well, have you heard about, you know, Bob was developing a sitcom for HBO.
No.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Apparently
with
he was.
With popping up. But let's just hope he's doing, you know. The sect trafficked choir directed by, you know.
Did you just say the sex trafficked
I just made that
choir.
Up. I was just thinking, it's a choir made up of people who've been sex trafficked into the country with the conductor, Bob Dylan.
That would be great.
It's
that would
becoming
be a great
really
job.
So surreal writer's meeting.
Yeah.
It's just, this is our dream podcast, isn't it? Yeah. In so many ways.
Yes, you're not asleep. It's a real podcast.
I think you should give him a call.
Yeah. We just need to put
you and Bob in the same room. I think.
But it's got to be about the power of voluntary work and getting outside yourself.
Yes, I would like to see you and him working in a charity shop on the high street.
Yeah, a Christmas soup kitchen.
At Christmas time.
Yes, at Christmas. With a children's choir. It's got to have a choir.
So have you kept up with him? I don't mean on a personal level. I mean on a...
Does he not return your letters or anything?
No, we Skype.
But do you follow his latest stuff? Have you seen his Great American Standards? And
he's funny
that way.
That did send me in a little kind of spiral into watching all those. And like you say, I think I was like, there seems to be a real sort of honesty and connection with these songs. And then it sent me all the way back to when before he started doing his own material, like way, way back at the beginning. Mm. And I was like, wow, this is an amazing through line. Mm. And then I stopped being interested in him again. But I definitely did that because that's quite fascinating, isn't it? Because he's not like he came out with a collection of his own, you know, amazing 15 amazing songs.
No, far from it. I mean, when he was about 20 or even possibly younger, he was just covering a lot of songs that he'd picked up and seemed very, for
was
a while...
Was it all Woody Guthrie?
Yeah, very much. Stuff, and actually, there's a period of recordings from before he'd ever heard Woody Guthrie where he just wants to sound like Little Richard and then Buddy Holly, pretty much. And then Woody Guthrie sort of changed it. But he's trying to be an old grizzled blues man and he's 20.
Yeah.
You know, and then he writes the songs. And somebody was saying on Twitter today, somebody who was listening to folk music and was listening to Where Have All the Flowers Gone? And that was the standard of folk songs. And A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall drops in your lap. Imagine.
It's like a big dinosaur killing Bambi, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's... I'd love to think that music could be that important. And I love modern pop music. You know, I still really listen to a lot of it. But I really struggle with the notion that we would go, oh my God, have you heard this thing?
Yeah,
you
know? I guess
that just because we're...
I don't know, but I know that some... I was in a taxi today and the taxi driver was listening to modern pop music. And I just put on my earphones and that's when I was listening to another Self-Portrait. And I thought, I'd rather be in that world than in the modern world. But then that's just... me. I mean, was there anything that you, Christopher, any Dylan stuff that you can think of that really did put you off? I mean, you said that, I mean, his songs, because you said that you were put off by the fact that, yes, he had this troubled marriage and apparently there was...
And this is that thing that I think I was intrigued by with him, is that you sort of absorb you absorb this cultural baggage with some people, don't you? And I was absolutely guilty of that, and not really questioning it. And so I think then it became I don't know what the proper psychological term is, but there's a sort of the loop of self-confirmation. So when I would sort of hear bits, or someone would say, "Oh, have you heard the, you know, this is a really great song," I'd like, "Well, he just sounds like a pompous old white man to me." Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Then
so anything in which and so anything emotional, for example, I'd be like, "Well, boo-hoo, your life's terrible." Do you know what I mean? It sort of like becomes that
sure,
loop
absolutely.
Of where you can't, it's very hard to break it. So I would say the answer to your question is, yeah, virtually everything for like 20 years, you know. And that's a shame. And I love kind of having sort of slightly broken through and then wanting to go further. And, you know, I'd love to. It's not really what I do at this stage in my performing, but I'd love to do, you know, what Barb Younger does, and maybe one day do a collection of songs, and then and definitely sort of go, "This is a song I used to have a problem with, but now I realise it's actually really, really great." Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because we should, it seems to me, and this is a massive overstatement, but we're now encouraged to go through life going, don't like, and that there's got to be a lot more than that, where we go, "I don't like, but why? Why do I not like that?" And we sort of start to unpick it.
We've become very binary, haven't we? There's not much room for nuance, you know.
Yeah, and I think I went to a gallery in Tasmania, and they give you a sort of like iPad-y thing, and you literally go around going, like,
what, with each picture?
With each piece of work, not like. And then I did it for about 5 minutes because I was told to. And then I was like, no, let's got to move. Let's move beyond liking and not liking.
No, exactly.
Being like you say, being what was the word you used? Being scared, you know, or being confronted by 20 years of work. That's great. Mm. You know, it's not easy, but it's a very rich state instead of.
I mean, Dylan is the perfect one to sort of change your mind about, because his stuff is so generally oblique.
Mm.
Yesterday I looked again at Series of Dreams. I don't know if you know that song. It, because I have been dreaming about Bob Dylan. Because I've had this, been doing this podcast, and it's you know, affecting my subconscious.
Mm.
And so I thought I would look at Series of Dreams, the song, as I was having a series of dreams about Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
And it was a song that I thought I knew, but it turns out I didn't know it at all. I've heard it dozens of times, but just looking at the words of it, there's a line, "Into the path you are thrown." And I've always had a picture of somebody being thrown into a path, but I thought it works on many different levels, like who's doing the throwing?
Hurled.
What? Hurled into the path.
Yeah.
Is it "into the path you are hurled"?
Yeah, because it rhymes with "world." Yeah.
Okay, "into the path you are hurled," which of course is an even better. And but what is the path? What was his path? Was it? And was it in the path? I always see him as being about to be trampled by horses or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it just every single line, I looked through that. It took me like half an hour to look at this song, and I still didn't understand it any better. But it was a great. You can do that with Dylan. You can't do that with, you know, a pop song. It can be very moving up to a point, but it's not generally complex.
That's why there have been so many cover versions, and that's
I think it's why the work lasts as well, because you can't go don't like.
Yes.
You can go, "I'll come back to this when I'm 50.
That's when I'm grown
Maybe
up.
They'll understand it.
And that's why my way in has definitely been through two cover versions, and that is the mark of a really amazing writer.
Were there any other cover versions that you remember that being particularly formative?
Yes, "Boots of Spanish Leather." That's because, again, it took me ages to work out that was a Dylan song.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because I first heard it through Nancy Griffith from her Other Voices, Other Rooms project, which I loved. And that led me into all sorts of songwriters like John Prine and, you know, whole load of really amazing people. And I really loved that song. And then I was like, oh, no, it's by Bob Dylan.
Another one.
Why does this keep happening? And then, and I do remember that, like, then going, and then listening to his version of it and going, no, you see. And then, and that is a song, you know, you have songs, you know, when you're walking on your own and it's a bit, you're a bit quiet and you sort of have songs that comfort you. Do you know what I mean? You sort of like, you kind of go back to them and you sort of half sing it as you're walking along. And that's one of mine. And I'm like, maybe it'll turn out differently this time.
Do you know what I mean?
Like maybe. You do want it to.
Yeah.
There's a version, forgive me if I've spoken about this on a podcast before, but there's a version of Boots of Spanish Leather where he introduces it by saying, this is one of those songs about you never get what you want. I'm paraphrasing. But, and I thought, oh, that's an interesting way of looking at the song. And then I listened to the song with that playing in my head, and it all became this very moving thing about the fact that he wanted this woman not to go, and she kept saying, is there anything I can send you? I'm going. Would you like this? Can I get you this? And no, there's nothing you can send me, my own true love. Just come back. And then as the song progresses, you realise that she's not coming back. And when she does come back, the relationship is dead. And he sort of starts to accept that as the song goes on. And then kind of ends it with a joke and says, well, if you are really leaving, bring me back some boots, you know, to kick me out of your life with. And it's this awful, bittersweet kind of punchline, but it's so moving. Maybe I'm getting old and weepy, but
really? But that always hit me in that way, in that kind of thing of I really remember it resonating with me emotionally, and sort of like, you know, times when my dad would like say, I'll take you out and buy you something, and I was like, well, you might as well, because you know, you know what I mean? And I really remember it's like, well, all right, you can, yes.
And that notion that actually when we're very, very depressed and very, very sad and we're missing something, nothing will take the place. And somebody's saying, is there something I can get you?
Yeah.
Well, no, actually, not that will fill this void. No, thanks for asking.
No, thanks. But, you know, go on then.
Yeah.
Go on, anything, randomly. Yeah. And then I can take it back.
Exactly.
Money back.
But give me the receipt. That's what it should have said. I'll have a pair of boots of Spanish leather, but can you just give me the receipt?
Swap.
I didn't scan, though.
So that, I mean, that's another example of it. And a great singer to interpret it and pull something out that it could relate to. And maybe, there are people that make the song slightly less problematic. And that's also fine in as well, I think.
What other covers do you have?
I've just printed out all the words to the answer my friend is blowing in the wind in German, which I got very carried away with.
If you and Barb Junger don't record this before the year's out, I'll take it personally. As Marlene Dietrich, please.
Yes.
I think we're going to wrap it up, Christopher, unless you've got a final Marlene Dietrich you want to give us or... Not to put you on the spot.
Well, no, but I did.
Tina C.
What would Tina do? No, I definitely was very influenced by that, and I did start learning German when I was like 20 or something. I think it was college, and then they said, why does everybody want to learn German? And everybody went, because we're going to Germany. Well, my aunt is German, and I was like, I really like Marlene Dietrich songs as arranged by Burt Bacharach. I like to understand them. And literally, I remember the teacher going, say what now? Because I really did.
It's different.
Because she did all sorts of, she did like a puff, der Salpertrachen, Liebtum. I was like, this is amazing. All these kind of counter-revolutionary, counter-culture songs. But sung, arranged by Burt Bacharach. It's genius. Anyway, so no.
Thank you, Christopher Green. Is It Rolling Bob Talking Dylan is recorded in the Betty Davis Suite at Lip Sync Studios.
Engineered by Mark Langley Smith and produced by Robin Guise.
We're on Twitter at Is It Rolling Pod.
Music is by Sam Hare.
Well, it's always been my nature to take chances. My right hand drawing back while my left hand advances, where the current is strong and the monkey dances to the tune of a concertina.